said Ben is by far the best level of three.
Okay, if you've got your homework assignments, this slack water deposit thing, I'll take those. Anytime today's fine. If, drop it by my office, email, whatever is easiest for you. But it's interesting how everybody has used the same picture. And Kat, you probably should have put a little copyright on.
I did copyright this.
Because I think it's all the ones you took, so.
Yeah,
you could be sitting on a pile of money now if you played your cards right. So our plan this week for Thursday is we're going to make every effort to get outside. And tentatively, unless it looks like the weather will be somewhat cooperative, it's going to be warmer anyway. So, and things are getting an opportunity to dry out a little bit this week. So what I think we will do is meet up by the tennis courts by Memorial Gym. And a lot of you have been in that old arboretum there. It's called the Shattuck Arboretum, where the trees are. And we'll probably, what we'll be doing is digging some soil pits in there and working on some descriptions. And I think because of the number of people we have, we may have to split up into two different groups. You know, have one group come at 1:30 and then the second group come at 3:30. But I'll give that a little bit more thought. Is there anybody that is not going to be here on Thursday? Okay. So we probably will have to split up because we can't dig up the whole arboretum. They would frown on that. Okay, so the other, what we're going to do today is continue on through the soil orders. And if you, hopefully everybody's got the information downloaded. If you want to get the notes, you know, should look like this, where it's exactly what you're getting off of this 12 Soil Orders website, but I've just made the handout so you can scribble notes on it. Might make it a little bit easier. And then there's the supplemental material there as well that we'll cover. So if you remember last week, we got started on the soil orders and we went through the gelosols and mentioned they are the first order that keys out. And as we work our way down the list, you can see the next group of soils that come out are the histosols, and simply put, those are the organic soils, meaning that they contain how much organic matter? At least 20%, okay, 20 to 30%, depending on how much clay size material is in there. So simply put, these are the organic soils, and less simply put, you know, we were looking at the actual descriptions in soil taxonomy, and remember the nice simple one for the gelosols that we had here? Well, if you look at the histosols, it starts to get a little bit more complicated. And I think if nothing else, this really drives home the point about how soil taxonomy is a quantitative system. We don't need to go through this whole definition, but you can see that there are a lot of numbers that pop up here. 60% or more, 60 centimeters, 40 centimeters, 50 centimeters, 10 centimeters or less, 30 days or more, and 0.1 grams per cubic centimeter. So a lot of quantitative limits that are placed on these categories. And if you read through all of this, you know, you come down to the histosols. And the other thing I want to point out is that when you read these keys in taxonomy, they use a lot of ands and ors, and it really the word either. So it's really difficult to read these definitions sometimes. But if you look at this one, okay, it would be other soils that these are the ones that don't have permafrost, and it would be they don't have andic properties, and they have organic materials meeting one or more of these things. And I don't want to worry too much about it, but you notice in here, saturated with water for 30 days or more per year, normal years, and so on. Because this is part of the idea of histosols, is that most of them are pretty wet soils. And the reason that you have an organic soil there is because of restricted drainage in most cases, not all, but most. So anyway, this is the formal definition for the histosols, or if you like the simple definition, organic soils. And if we go to the histosols here, this is the more general information, but the word histosol comes from the Greek root, or the Greek word histos, which means tissue, and in this case, it's probably best to think of it as in plant tissue, because that's where most histosols are derived. Soils contain mainly organic materials, 20-30% organic matter by weight, and are more than 40 centimeters thick. So this is the distinction between a thick O-horizon that might be part of a forest floor versus an actual organic soil or a histosol. Now this isn't always true, but in general you need to have about 40 centimeters or more of this organic material, and I'll show you one exception. The other thing about histosols is that they, in addition, because they are primarily organic materials, they have very, very low bulk densities. And it's mentioned here, often less than 0.3 grams per cubic centimeter. What's water for bulk density? One, yeah, just as a point of comparison. Most mineral soils are probably about 1.3, 1.4, somewhere in there. So this is really light material. And that kind of figures into the some of the engineering considerations that we'll mention here in a second. It says here, most histosols form in settings such as wetlands where restricted drainage inhibits the decomposition of plant and animal remains. And it's primarily plant remains in most cases. And that's what allows these organic materials to accumulate over time. They just don't break down very fast. Because remember, decomposition is predominantly an aerobic process. And if you have an oxygen-limited environment, which would be the case in a wetland setting where you've got water, so much water, the decomposition is going to be very slow. And in terms of production, most wetlands are considered to be the most productive ecosystems on Earth. If you think about net primary productivity, they're really high. So you get the case where you've got production that greatly exceeds the decomposition rate. So you get this net accumulation of organic materials over time. The histosols have received a lot of attention in the last couple of decades simply because of this idea of their role in the global carbon cycle. Because if you look at the amount of carbon stored in soils, histosols are going to be at the top of the list. I haven't seen estimates of, you know, what percentage of total carbon is stored in histosols, and if I did see figures on it, I think they would be kind of suspect, because it's a difficult thing to come up with, but they definitely would be the highest, and gelosols would probably be right behind them. So the thing about histosols, they are not really extensive. If you look at the maps here, globally, it's about 1.2% of the land area, not much at all. And you can see on the map here, this green, kind of lime green color. You don't see a lot of big areas other than up in Canada. And one of the big exports of Canada is peat. And in fact, if you go to a lawn and garden store and buy a big bag of peat moss for something, chances are it'll say product of Canada. And the other areas up in Scandinavia and Russia, Northern Asia, you can see parts down here in Southeast Asia as well where you get histosols. A lot of these are in low-lying coastal areas as well. So not very extensive in terms of the aerial extent, a little over a percent. But if you look at the United States, we're 1.6%, something like that. But again, these maps, the way that they're set up, the dark brown color means that, in that pixel on the map, that more than 75% of the soils there would be histosols. And as you get to these lighter and lighter colors, less and less. So this really light color down here, it's only 1 to 10%. The areas without any shading, it's less than 10%. So where do you find most histosols? Well, look at the Gulf Coast, and the Atlantic coast, and really the upper Midwest would be the main areas of them. You can see in the western U.S., there's just some colors that there's not a lot of dark colors that show up, and they're kind of scattered. And I think that's characteristic of a lot of the histosols that we have out here, is that they're pretty localized areas, and it's usually determined by landscape position. The histosols tend to be in the lower lying landscape positions, a little bit wetter. You can see Florida has got an awful lot of histosols. This is the Everglades down here, this big brown spot on there. And Alaska, especially in the coastal areas, you can see quite a few histosols there. So when you always, people hear these jokes about swampland for sale in Florida, they're probably talking about a histosol that is for sale. Classification of these things, and we'll get that in just a second. This other note here, the terms peat and mux. Everybody's heard the term peat, and we talked about that in terms of the amount of decomposition, and we said that peat represents organic materials that are relatively only slightly decomposed. You can still identify plant fibers, and most peats are derived from different types of mosses. And so you can recognize the fibers because they haven't broken down to the point where you don't have any recognizable plant parts there. And contrast that with this term muck, and that would be the other end of the spectrum, where you have organic materials that are so highly decomposed they tend to be colloidal, in other words, really, really small particle size. And if you take a muck and put it in your hand and rub your fingers back and forth, you will probably not see anything like plant fibers. It's just very, very, very fine organic particles. And as I said, most of it would be colloidal size. The engineering properties are something that are a real issue with organic soils. And the two biggest problems are, number one, because they have such a low bulk density, they have what an engineer might call a low bearing or weight bearing capacity. In other words, you can't put much weight on top of a histosol because it's going to tend to compress or collapse. And the other big problem with histosols is that because most of them are wet, and if you say you're going to build a house on one or a road, first thing you need to do is drain it. And what happens if you drain a histosol? Well, you go from being having an anaerobic situation that allows organic materials to accumulate, and you really reverse that, turn it into an aerobic situation. What's going to happen to all that organic matter? Well, it starts to oxidize or decompose, and eventually you're going to see the land level go down, and in some cases pretty extreme, and I'll show you some examples of that. So that's a big problem, one that has to be dealt with. The other thing about land use, mentioned here that histosols are mined for fuel and horticultural products as well, like the bagged peat moss that you purchase at a lawn and garden store. So for classification, we have five suborders of histosols, and here's how they would key out. The first suborder is known as the folists. And these are kind of the oddballs with the histosols because they are not poorly drained soils. These are going to be the soils that you don't find in a wetland environment. And it says here, this is the simplified definition, but the folists are the histosols that aren't saturated with water for long periods of time during the year. In other words, they're more well drained. And if you think about the conditions, where would you expect to find the net accumulation of organic matter but still a well-drained environment? What's that? Areas that are cold. The map of Alaska showed some histosols. A lot of those histosols up there are folus, and they occur in areas where there's just a lot of precipitation. So you get enough precipitation that it really promotes lots of biomass production, but it's still a well-drained environment. But it just, because of cold temperatures and so on, you end up with these better-drained pholas. And I'll show you another example of those too. The second suborder that comes out, these are called wasists, and these are fairly new to the taxonomy system just in the last couple years. But these are histosols that are submerged for more than 21 hours a day. And the idea is that a lot of coastal areas in particular, like you see in the Atlantic coast and Gulf coast, you have these tidal areas where they're actually soils because of the fact that you've got vegetation and you have evidence of soil forming processes, but they are submerged most of the time. It's fairly shallow water, because in order to have plants there, you're going to have photosynthesis and so on. So it's not deep water, but it's shallow water, and the soils themselves are only going to be exposed to air for relatively short periods of time. I don't think anyone has a good idea how widespread these things are, but the examples I know of are mostly in the northeast and the southeast coastal areas. The three main suborders, or the more common ones, would be these last three. And the first one that you see there listed, fibrists, and these are histosols that are made up of only slightly decomposed organic materials, often called peat. What would be the horizon designation for something that would probably be called a fibrist? Okay, oh yeah, with the I being slight decomposition. And then the next suborder to key out would be the saprists, and these are the histosols that are primarily made up of highly decomposed organic materials, often called muck, and the horizon designation for a saprist is most likely going to be OA. And then finally, the default category would be the hemists, and these are the histosols that are made up of moderately decomposed organic materials. Or in other words, horizon designation likely would be the O with the E, yeah. So intermediate decomposition. If you want to think about these suborders in terms of the how they might fit together in one of these diagrams, the ternary diagram doesn't work very well. And so here's how they would array themselves. If you think about well-drained up here at the top, this would include the pholists, all right? And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got submerged soils. These would be the wasists, the ones that submerge for at least 21 hours a day. And then these other three suborders, fibrous, hemus, and saprous, are simply arrayed on the basis of how highly decomposed the organic materials are, with fibrous only slightly decomposed, saprous highly decomposed on this end, and then the hemists kind of intermediate there. This is a map of the United States that shows the distribution of some of these suborders, and you notice that if you look at these coastal areas, Florida and parts of the Atlantic coast, this green color indicates saprous. So these would be the muck types of soils. And as you get up the upper Midwest, still have a lot of saprists, but you start to see this blue color, those are the hemists. And this map doesn't show it, but when you get up into Canada, probably a lot of those histosols would show up as being fibrists, a lot of the peat areas, the northern peatlands, peat bogs. And something like the pholists really doesn't show up on the map very well. There's a few dots on here in the west. I don't know if those are specks of dust or if they actually represent the soils themselves. Down in southwestern Oregon, you can see there's an area of hemists down there in the Klamath Basin. But as I said, most of the histosols you find in the West are going to be very localized. You're not going to see big expanses of them. Okay, some of the examples of these things. This is a coastal area, Atlantic coast in North Carolina. And this is the landscape there. You can tell it's wet. There's standing water everywhere. These histosols, I should mention, are highly valued for organic production, especially of root crops. And think about something like a carrot. If you grow a carrot in a soil that has a bulk density of 0.3, you've got a good chance of getting a nice, perfectly formed carrot, right? If you grow a carrot in a soil with a bulk density of 1.5, it may look kind of gnarled or twisted and probably not nearly as appealing to the consumer. So there is a lot of ag production in these low-lying areas, but the problems in histosols, but the problems are just this excess water. And you can see the field here, water in the furrows, and then there's a big drainage ditch here where the drainage ditch is simply designed to help lower the water table a little bit. And you can't really see it, but this is a pretty elaborate pumping apparatus that's taking the water out of that ditch and pumping it out of there. Because I think a lot of these areas are just going to be a few feet above sea level, so it's really difficult to get rid of that excess water. But they do make for good cropping soils because of the low bulk density. An example of a soil profile, I think you've seen this one before. This is one from up in Michigan, and if you look at the name up here, marly, uic, mesic, limnic, haplosaprous. So if you dissect that name, obviously histosol, at the suborder level, it is a saprist, or one of these muck-type soils, highly decomposed. And a lot of you ran across this term haplo when you were doing the last homework assignment. And haplo simply means what? Simple. And the idea here is it's simple horizonation. There's nothing unusual about it, like the presence of other types of horizons. It's in a case like this, you've got OA, OI horizons. That's considered simple. You don't have intermixed mineral horizons in there. And then down, if you look at the subgroup level, limnic haplosaprous. And remember we talked about limnic materials back when we were going through the master horizon symbols. You might recall the capital A, or capital L, which we said is only used in the case of histosols. And you can see it's right here in the bottom. And remember the MA designation on it, what that stands for? Marl, yeah. Yeah, Bryce?
Is it common to have more composition above, less, or more decomposition above, less decomposition?
That's a good question. I don't know. I it makes sense from the standpoint that if you've got a wet soil, the chances are that the upper part of it is going to be where you've got aerobic conditions more often, right? So you might expect more decomposition. But as a general rule with these things, I don't know if that's always true. So this a little bit bigger view doesn't help too much, but you notice down here, this is that marl material, the light colored material you see at the bottom there, and it's not organic material per se, but we described marl as being a calcareous clayey type of material. And in this case, so you've got what, about three feet of organic material on top of that. And the note here, it says the layer of marl, LMA, is a layer of soft calcareous clay at about 76 centimeters. So the groundwater table fluctuates and you get periodic decomposition. And that could be a good reason why you have the more decomposed stuff up closer to the surface. It makes sense to me. It says when these soils are drained for cultivation, aerobic oxidation can occur rapidly in warm climates. We'll see some real good examples of that. They do use these things for cropping. But one thing about wetlands that you must keep in mind is that for probably about 200 years in this country, what did we do with wetlands? drain them. They were looked at as a waste of good land because you got this wet soil, and the tendency was to go in and drain them so you could crop them, build on them, whatever the case may be. And then in 1977, the Clean Water Act was passed in the United States, and this made a lot of difference because there were a lot of parts of the Clean Water Act, but one of the key provisions was that it made it illegal to dump either sediment or any type of pollutant into waterways, including wetlands. So as far as filling wetlands and draining them, that's when they started to receive federal protection. And because of that, most areas, the original wetlands, there are very few of them that actually remain today. And I think in Idaho, you know, we've only got maybe half of the original wetlands. And if you go to the upper Midwest, part of the Corn Belt, those probably only have about, you know, 10 or 20% of the original wetlands. But the trend is kind of reversed in recent years, where now that wetlands are protected, you don't see as much draining of them. But it was pretty common for a long time.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I know that because it's a pretty good commercial business. People are making wetlands. How are those? Like, are those becoming histosols, or can you make a histosol?
It's pretty difficult to make a histosol, but it I think in many cases over time, that's what will happen. And that's a good point. You mentioned making wetlands, and this is something that's actually become a pretty big business. And the idea is that now that I guess the goal is to have no net loss of wetlands. And because of that, what people will do, say you want to put a subdivision in, and maybe there's a little area of wetlands there, what you'd be required to do is mitigate by establishing a wetland somewhere else. And so there's been a lot of research that's gone into how do you recreate the three aspects of a wetland, which would be the wetland hydrology, a hydric soil, and then the hydrophytic vegetation. And I guess the jury's still out because a lot of these have only been done, say, in the last couple of decades. But it looks like that at least from the initial observations that it can be done. But you know, creating a histosol per se is going to take a long time. And wetlands don't necessarily have to have organic soils. There are wetlands that have mineral soils, but they're obviously they wouldn't be classified as histosols.
But is that still counting? I mean, what's the difference between, you know, changing this histosol into something like make a wetland that's not, will it have the same functions and carbon stuff? Is that
it's probably a good question, and maybe over time, but it might take thousands of years, because you look at a lot of the wetlands that we have around here. Most of the work that's been done on them suggests that they are a few thousand years old. And so you get this incremental accumulation of organic material, but it's going to take a long time. But as far as the function, maybe it's possible to restore that, you know, in a much shorter period of time. But that's a difficult thing to measure. You know, we call wetlands nature's kidneys. And the idea is they're so good at filtering water and sediment and pollutants, so that kind of function may be a difficult thing to reproduce. Oh, the rest of this name up here, if you look at the family level, you've got Marley, Uick, and Mesic. Well, you should recognize at least a couple of those terms. Mesic refers to soil temperature regime. And Marley obviously refers to the presence of marl. So that's kind of the mineralogy thing here. This term Uick, not going to see that very often at a family level, but it when you do see it, it generally means that it has a higher pH than might be expected. So you might want to make a note of that. This EU, and you're going to see it in some other forms as we get into some of the other soil orders. Yeah.
So this means it's a higher pH relative to what you would expect, not necessarily.
Right. And
pH.
Right. Okay. And what do you suppose is causing the higher pH here? Well, you've got a calcareous clayey material down here, this marl, and that's probably what's responsible for. The other thing about UIC, it also indicates higher pH or higher base status, and you know, calcium, magnesium, potassium, and that I think would be directly attributable in this case to the marl that's in the bottom. Okay, subsidence. Oh no, let's look at North Idaho. This is a local example. This is up in Bonner County, North Idaho. We do actually have a lot of histosols up there, but again, they're in pretty localized areas. And one of the things that you'll see is, if you remember that map of the United States, the upper Midwest, you have all those histosols up there. It's not uncommon to find them in areas that have been glaciated. And one thing that glaciers do when they come through an area is they really screw up the drainage. And I think that's the case in areas in northern Idaho where the glaciers came down, the whole drainage system is disrupted, and you end up with these wet areas that are usually pretty low-lying, but they're not very well drained. And you can see this example here, it's pretty flat, low-lying. I imagine there's a stream waterway very close by. And so this would be the type of setting where you'd expect to see a wetland. But you notice the forested slopes off in the distance, you know, those certainly would be well-drained soils there. But, so right here in the foreground, and in this case, here's the soil that goes with it. And this is one that's been drained. Notice the horizon designation on here up at the top, an OAP. It's not something you see very commonly, but an organic plow layer. And what happened here is, as in the case of some of these meadows up there, they want to use them for grazing, so they drain them, and then they come in and might put some sort of a seed mix in. So that really counts as cultivation, even though it's not plowed on an annual basis. But there does look like there's kind of a boundary in there. But you can see the horizon designations, OAP, OA, OE, and then notice this bottom one, OA with a prime on it. Did we talk about what that prime means? I can't remember if we did or not. Well, you'll see this occasionally, and the way it's used, if you look at the horizons, we have an OA horizon listed the second from the top. So if you want to have another OA designation down there, you've got to have some way of distinguishing it from the first one, right? And we don't use a 1 and a 2 because they're not adjacent to one another. So we just put that little prime on it. So you talk about the OA horizon up here, and then this would be the OA prime. So it's just a way of indicating it's a different horizon when they're not right next to one another, and you can designate them with the 1 and the 2s. But this is a UIC frigid typic haplosaprist. So it's very similar to the one we saw before, the haplosaprist, except this one's not limnic. And here's an example where you see the term typic come in at the subgroup level. So it's the typical haplosaprist. It doesn't have a limnic layer in it. You'll notice the term UIC in there again. And then frigid, which refers to frigid temperature regime. Now you notice in this classification, do you see anything about moisture regime? No, it doesn't say specifically. And the idea here is that you assume for most histosols that the moisture regime is what? Aquic, yeah, because they're poorly drained. And that's probably true in most cases. Well, this northern Idaho soil, I think we kind of mentioned all of this, but it does say that a lot of these have been cleared, dike, drain for farming, use production of spring wheat, oats, barley, grass, seed, hay, and pasture. And some are used for wetland wildlife habitat. Yeah, Taylor.
In this case, the UIC characteristics is due by, because there's no mark, and organic matter shouldn't decrease the pH.
Yeah, there's no mark. In this case, I think it may be because it's a relatively young. And also, the waters that are feeding into this may have a higher pH. And they might come off of limestones or dolomites or some type of material that, that would promote a little bit higher pH. But I'm not really sure why or what the direct source of excess bases or higher pH would be in this case. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about land use. And this is an example of what happens with subsidence, if you're thinking about it on a volume basis, where on the left you've got the wet histic material, and then you dry it out, and you can see the 85% volume change there. So imagine what that does to the land surface. And here is a classic example of subsidence, and I'll zoom this in. This is in the Florida Everglades, and there have been a lot of the Everglades have been drained and put into ag production for sugar cane, you know, back in the early 1900s. And okay, this is a cement post that was put in the Everglades in 1924, and what they did is they went down till they hit some sort of mineral material or more stable substrate. So this thing was anchored in there. In 1924, the top of this post was the land surface. And then each one of these, I don't know why they use Roman numerals, but you can see there's a division, that's 1 foot, there's division, there's division, there's a division. This picture was taken in 1976. So you're looking at roughly 50 years of drainage of this thing. And you can see that it's been about 4.5 feet of subsidence, or the lowering of the ground level there. And that's kind of the rate of, you know, roughly about 1 foot every 10 years. You're seeing the ground surface lower. And that, I think some of the classic examples of this subsidence have been found in the Everglades and New Orleans and some of these histosol areas down there. But you can imagine the, well, some of the problems with engineering given this. Yeah, Bryce?
Like, will it kind of reach a capacity of, it won't shrink up anymore? Like, you know, since 1956, does it continue to shrink at that rate? Or, you know, will it kind of just...
Well, it depends on local conditions, but I have read where they estimate that a lot of the histosols in the drain parts of the Everglades by the year 2050, which, you know, it's only 37 years from now, there's probably just going to be a few centimeters of organic material over mineral material because of this sort of thing. And what they have looked at trying to reverse the process, which obviously if you want to do that, you got to make them wetter. And so they've been doing some work, experimental work with that. The problem is the rates of accumulation are much, much less than the rates of decomposition once you drain them. Who is it? Sorry, didn't mean to lock you out.
I thought that would happen.
Okay. Mentioned that these things are used for fuel, and not so much in the United States, but in areas of Europe, Scandinavia, Russia, Ireland, people go out and they mine these histosols. And they usually have these various tools that cut out big blocks, the histosols. They kind of flip them up, let the things dry, and then come back and get them later. And then they haul this stuff off and use it because they don't have wood. You can see in this landscape in Scotland, there's not much woody material there to use for fuel. So they use these histosols. And if you read in here, it says on a per pound basis, histosols might have an energy value of about 8,300 BTUs compared to 6,000 for wood and maybe 9,500 for lignite coal. So I guess the point is there's a lot of energy stored in these histosols, and they actually compare pretty favorably with other more traditional fuels such as wood and coal.
Question.
Yeah.
Do they release them more carbon though into the atmosphere because they store more? Is that the problem?
Well, yeah, you're taking carbon that is stored and you are releasing it. So, I mean, we do the same thing when we burn firewood or... Okay, the last example of a histosol, and this is an example of a pholist, and I think we had looked at these earlier. Now remember, the pholists are the ones that are better drained, okay? They're not saturated with water all the time. And this particular example is from down in southern Idaho at Craters of the Moon. And here's zoom in. And what you're looking at is a very shallow soil that is sitting on top of fairly recent basalt. That's one of the things about Craters of the Moon. It's got all these really young basalt flows. And when you look at it from a distance, it just looks like rock everywhere. But if you take a closer look, you actually find that there are plants growing out there. And these plants are really creating these pholas, or these shallow organic soils. Because in this case, the shrub that you see here looks like some kind of a juniper. But on an annual basis, the litter gets shed, and it accumulates in this crack. And because of this is fairly dry climate, it's fairly cool down there, probably limits the decomposition. And this organic matter piles up over time. And this is not a deep soil, but if you think about this, getting the vegetation established there, and it might trap some dust. And eventually, you can envision this thing sort of spreading out over the entire lava flow. But they're not impressive soils in terms of depth, but they do help support plant life. And what you'll see in a lot of these is you get a pioneer plant that comes in. It sheds enough litter to make enough of a soil there that another plant can take root. And slowly, you start to expand over the lava flows. Yeah, Lee? Yeah, but you get into the fine print, and usually in the case of having a lithic contact, which is exactly what you'd have here, then it's from, you know, roughly just organic material down to a lithic contact. So a lot of those thickness or depth requirements get waived when you start running into bedrock and similar types of features. So that's how this one would qualify. But if you look at the classification of it, okay, it says dicic, which is the opposite of euic, so that means this one is acid. Micro, what does that suggest? Really small, or in this case, really, really shallow. Frigid, temperature regime. Lithic, torifolist. Okay, so you've got a suborder is the folist. And then do you remember the formative element tori, T-O-R-R-I? That refers to an aridic or toric moisture regime. So it's an aridic moisture regime. And then lithic at the subgroup level refers to the presence of a lithic contact within some distance of the surface, usually not very much. So that's what you see there. And then the micro, of course, means that it's a really shallow soil, less than 15 centimeters thick, I think is the way it reads. I have to go back and check that. Anyway, an interesting idea, and probably what you can think of as early stage soil and plant succession, where you take bare rock and you maybe get one of these little pholas on there, and eventually it could turn in, and probably will turn into a mineral soil if you assume that there's going to be enough dust blowing around down there to accumulate. Okay, I had a couple more the supplemental images for you just to look at real quickly. This is another great example of this subsidence in the Florida Everglades. This was a house built down there. There's a guy standing here. This was the foundation. You only had to go up one or two steps to go in onto the front porch. And now you got to go up quite a few steps to get in. Anybody know what this thing is? This big
William Taft's coffin.
No, close.
It's the well.
It's not a well. It's a septic tank. And if you know anything about septic tanks, these are normally buried, you know, a few feet below the ground level, which it would have been, and now it's exposed up at the surface. If you downloaded this, I think I changed this print. There was a mistake on what it did say, but this subsidence in agricultural areas of the Everglades averages about 2 centimeters a year. And I think in there it said 3 to 9 feet. It says per year, it should just say 3 to 9 feet total. And they're looking at the, not on an annual basis, but just total. So, and you can see this is getting pretty close to, figure this guy's about 6 feet tall. It looks like we've had at least 7 or 8 feet of subsidence there. This is a peatland up in North Idaho, and it's an example of a histosol that is characterized by having shallow water on it. And this is not a wassist, but it's probably getting close. And one of the dominant plants up there is this moss called Campylium stellatum. And I don't know if you can tell it here, but it's actually growing under about a foot or foot and a half of water. So it can photosynthesize even when it's submerged like that. And this type of moss builds up over time. And this was a little project we were doing up there, but this would be the soil surface, and this was taken out with an auger. And there was some of this moss that was recognizable down at a depth of about 75 centimeters. It was carbon dated at 1,700 years old. And if you do the math with the 75 centimeters and the 1,700 year old date, you can come up with an accumulation rate. And in this case, it's about 0.04 centimeters per year, or 0.017 inches per year. And I guess the point here is, I think I said earlier, the accumulation rate is much, much slower than the decomposition or subsidence rate once you drain these things. I mean, we're talking about several orders of magnitude less. So it's easy to decompose the stuff by draining it. It's a lot more difficult to accumulate the organic matter over time. And the last one here is this. How many people have heard of this guy, the Tolland man from Denmark? This is probably the best preserved human body found anywhere in the world. He was found in a histosol in Denmark. This family was out cutting peat on the weekend. This is a great family activity. You go out and cut blocks of peat. And they were digging down, and I think they found the head. And they immediately called the police because there had been someone that had gone missing there, and they thought it might be the person that was missing. So the police come out, and they start looking at this thing, and they realize, you know, that this is this guy's a little bit older than that. So they get the folks from the museum and come out, and they eventually excavated this thing and did some carbon dating on it and found out that it was about 2,350 years old. So this was back in 1950, so that would put him back at about, 400 BC, something like that. And you can see the face on here. They all that's preserved now is the head. And I don't know, it's on display in Denmark, and they won't see it. This guy's got his own website, tollandman.dk for Denmark. But there's a lot of information about it. And as I understand it, once they excavated this thing out, they had a very difficult time preserving the body. It sort of fell apart on them, but they did manage to do some things to keep the head intact. The other interesting thing about this is, notice there's a rope around the neck that was also preserved. And they assumed that this guy got hung. They did some forensics on it. But all the stuff that they could figure out, they could even take the contents out of the digestive system and figure out what the last meal this guy ate was, because the seeds were still intact.
But that was fun.
Well, I don't know. It's all in the name of science. So they don't really know what happened to this guy, why he was tossed in there, but obviously it happened such a long time ago. No one's around to tell. But one note, if any of you guys are ever thinking about killing somebody and you want to dispose of a body, don't go throwing it in a histosol, because this is exactly what's going to happen. You're not going to be getting rid of the evidence. Now, after 2,300 years, the statute of limitations has probably run out. But, go for well-drained soil.
Why was he so well-preserved?
Oh, yeah, okay, good question. Why is he so well-preserved? Two things. Number one, it's a histosol and a peatland, so probably a fibrous. So it's anaerobic conditions. And the other thing, this particular bog was very acidic. And as I understand it, the acidic nature also is one of the things that's going to inhibit is microbial activity. even more so, in addition to the having a lack of oxygen. So it's really two factors, but that's pretty good preservation for 2300. Okay, so we'll, on when, no, Thursday,